Well, I'm here today with Paul Dolanoy, who is a member of our advisory board, an esteemed member. Also serves on the NYSTRS Real Estate Advisory Committee and a longtime Equitable person. I'd love if you could maybe first give us a little bit of background on your professional journey.
Well, thank you, Ryan. It's nice to be with you. I'm going to go back a little over 50 years when this all started.
When you were five?
When I was getting out of college, I had the opportunity to go to Europe with a professor friend of mine and drive his car. So we spent 3 months in Europe touring many beautiful countries.
Wow.
And when I came back, I met with my dad, and my dad said, "What are you going to do now?" I said, "Maybe I'll go for my master's degree." He said, "I suggest you get a job." So I went into the placement office, and at that time, a placement office had index cards, and there was a job for Equitable Life and Equitable Real Estate. And I picked it up and I answered, and started that in 1969.
Wow.
My first day on the job, it was really interesting. My boss said to me, "Paul, I want you to learn as much as you can about pension funds and real estate, because I think it's going to be a big part of our business." And that was the start of it. And then they transferred me from New York to San Francisco. And two companies really are responsible for starting institutional investing in real estate. Mm-hmm. The first was Prudential, mm-hmm. and their chief actuary was a gentleman named Meyer Melnikoff, and he came up with this idea of providing an evergreen core open-end fund which invests in real estate. Mm-hmm. And he called that fund PRISA. And then Equitable shortly thereafter formed another open-end fund, and it was called Separate Account 8. Now it's called the Prime Property Fund, and that is now managed by Morgan Stanley. But if you fast forward from that time to current times, both of those funds are still in existence.
Wow.
They have multi-billion dollar open-end funds. They may have changed the structure into a private REIT, but they're both flourishing. And I remember in those early days, it's interesting when you look at the complexity of what we have now, the property types were really simple. Mm-hmm. Industrial properties, mostly warehouses, office buildings, mostly downtown office buildings, and shopping centers, mostly regional shopping centers. Apartments weren't even in the mix at that time. It was really, really the start of it. And I remember calling on corporate pension funds in San Francisco in the Bay Area. I remember specifically calling on Crown Zellerbach, Foremost McKesson, and Chevron. And when I went into those meetings, they said, "Well, why should we invest in real estate?" And some of the reasons I said then now still stand true today. You invest in real estate for diversification, a more efficient frontier. You invest in real estate for income, and then the potential for appreciation, and it's a hard asset. So that's how it all started in that. And then from then, it's just become more complex.
Well, and so back to those kind of early days. So you're saying that when Prudential and Equitable first kind of came up with these funds, prior to that, essentially, pensions had not meaningfully invested in real estate at all. They were just stocks and bonds?
Stocks and bonds, and they had something called private placement bonds. And that was primarily what they did. Insurance companies were investing in debt, mortgages. They were making mortgages at that time. And that was the whole thing. And some of the insurance companies that invested in mortgages, when properties didn't go as well, they ended up owning those real estate. So they said, in addition to lending, we may as well own the real estate as well.
Yeah, so, and they started to develop the expertise.
Yes. And it was interesting, the investors at that early stage were really three primary investors, and we could contrast that to what's happening today. They were corporate pension funds, and pension funds were flourishing. Now everybody's switching over to defined contribution or 401k plans. There were public pension funds as well, but they preferred a separate account strategy, although they would invest in some of the open-end funds. And then there was something called Taft-Hartley or union pension funds. And those were the three primary investors in these open-end funds, especially in the early 5 or 6 or 7 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then fast forward to today, you mentioned, you know, it was effectively just 3 property types that people invested in.
Yeah.
And how is that different today? What is the different composition of asset types and also investors?
Yeah. So on the asset type, the largest one was multifamily or apartments. Yeah. That started to take place and really has become a major component. And then there were subsections of the downtown office buildings. Now you get to suburban office buildings.
Yeah.
Then you get the different stratifications of industrial,
yeah,
whether it's big box, bulk distribution, or small bay industrial.
Yeah.
And it all becomes a lot more complex, but a lot more effective because you're able to really do different strategies at different times along the risk return spectrum. And these early funds were really core funds.
Yeah.
It was before we got into core plus and opportunistic and everything else that's involved with what we see today in value add.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Fascinating. And how would you say the participants has changed in terms of investors?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it started out with those 3, but now you see, I remember going to Japan, and we saw the early investing by Japanese insurance companies.
Yeah,
we did ventures with Sumitomo and Nippon Life, and they started investing in the United States. Then you have your endowments, your foundations, your financial institutions, banks, insurance companies, and all sorts of iterations of all of these, like fund of funds and fund-specific investing. And it really is high net worth is what we're seeing in family office.
Yeah.
And they're even starting to segment high net worth into high net worth and ultra high net worth.
So yes.
The complexity is there, and the variety of investors are tremendous. And you got secondary investors now who want to buy pieces of existing funds that other investors may want to get out of as well.
Yeah. So you spent quite a bit of your career at Equitable Life.
Yeah.
If you had some lessons learned or some challenges along the way, I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, it was interesting. I think one of the things that we did early on is we invested with joint venture partners.
Mm-hmm.
And investing with partners is great when things are going great. When they're not going great, you know who your best investment partners are. So know your investment partner. Stay true to your core competency. Yeah. Don't try to drift outside what has made you great and what has made you successful. So that was another important thing. And another important thing is communication with your investors. I mean, it's always great to communicate the best news, but when things are tough or you're having some trials and tribulations, you still have to communicate.
Yeah.
But it's not only important to communicate what the problem is, but what the solution is for a specific product or issue, what's going on there.
How did you see that play out during the GFC, which I think was probably one of the biggest real estate declines that we've seen?
Yeah, I saw it play out, and especially, you know, being on the NYSTERS board, you saw the ones that were communicating and had solutions for a problem, and then you saw some, unfortunately, people run for the hills and not figure out, lose key employees.
Yeah.
I always looked at the people who stayed with companies in good times and bad times,
you know,
the team, the professionals that did that, and they always turned out to be the good investors. And also the people that could take a bad period of time like global financial crisis and see what's forward. And as we know, some of the best vintage years for future funds were during that period.
Absolutely.
And not too different than where we may be right now.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You're also, I know you're involved with Alliance Global Advisors, who helps advise emerging managers and managers that are transitioning into the institutional space. I'm curious, with your lens there and working with managers like us and others, what have you seen that has been successful for emerging managers, and where have you seen thing, you know, what is some advice that you could give to those managers that are really transitioning into the institutional space?
Just a few words about Alliance Global. They've really satisfied a need in the industry.
Yeah.
Placement agents provide some of it, consultants provide some of it, but they are squarely focused on best practices and what I like to say is getting advisors ready for prime time.
Yeah.
Whether it's their policies and procedures, their ESG or DEI policies, their presentations, tough questions. And I think that was really a great, valuable service that both Heather and Jen have provided to the community.
Yeah.
And it's been well accepted. The second part of that question was?
Just about what you've seen that has been successful for managers that are transitioning, attempting to transition into the institutional space, as well as, you know, maybe some lessons learned or things that haven't gone well.
Yeah. I think that the companies, you know, the industry is, you know, you have your major big advisors, your Blackstones and et cetera. But I've seen the emergence of some smaller niche advisors that are really focused on a specific strategy, whether it be like Griseida, where it's secondary and tertiary markets.
Yeah.
And have done it for a long period of time
and
have been successful. Sticking to that strategy has always been very successful to what got you into your business, where you've done it. And again, back to that concept of not drifting and staying true to your core competencies. I've seen people that had a great business and they decided, you know, I've invested in maybe industrials and now I'm going to be a developer.
Yeah.
And those things have gone wrong. I've also seen strategies where you've used leverage, even on mortgage vehicles. And we haven't talked about the variety of mortgage vehicles or debt vehicles where you use, you're lending, but you're also leveraging your position in that. And that hasn't worked well.
Yeah.
In certain markets, it could work well, but it hasn't overall. So again, staying true to what has got you in the business is really one of the most important things. And being able to, you know, stretch a little here and there based on, you know, markets, what you're trying to do, but always staying true to your core competency.
Yeah. That's really helpful. On the NYSTERS board, you've been a member for over 20 years, 25
years? Yeah, it's years? 25 years now.
Yeah. Maybe if you could speak, so NYSTERS, for those who don't know, is New York State Teachers Retirement System.
Yeah.
And you're on the Real Estate Advisory Committee.
Yeah.
Could you maybe speak to some highlights there or what you've learned in your involvement in NYSTERS?
Yeah, a couple of things. I remember one of the original deals we did was, and we haven't talked about entity level, where we would buy part of a company, help grow that company, and provide great cash flow, because cash flow is very important to these retirement systems. And that was one of the first investments I got involved with. But it all starts with NYSTERS with the staff.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a good staff, and they have a terrific educated staff up in Albany, and great executive director, that is the key for our advisory board. And we see exactly what they're doing. We help where we can. If we're in a specific market or we know a property type, the staff will ask us from time to time to look at it. But we rely on the staff and we provide, you know, guidance in certain areas, whether it could be insurance or a different asset class. And we have such a broad array of experience on that board, like Griseida has on their board. That's a terrific board as well.
Now that you are semi-retirement right now, and you've been able to get more involved in advisory capacities, I'd love to understand what, you know, attracted you to getting involved with the Griseida board, and what have you enjoyed about it?
Yeah, a little bit more. I've been involved with a lot of boards.
Yeah.
NYSTERS, we talked about. I chaired a board for J.P. Morgan, their income and growth fund.
Mm-hmm.
I've been on the Pension Real Estate Association's board and Alliance's board, and PREA's executive committee and a variety of other boards. When we met, I met you and Joe a few years ago,
yeah.
And we had met before, but we got into some serious discussions. And what I always say to myself when I meet people and say, might be engaged or involved with the company, I ask myself three questions. I said, do I like the people, the team?
Mm-hmm.
And I always have to answer that yes. And it was a clear yes with Griseida. You know, secondly, do I like their investment strategy, their investment thesis, and do I think they really have a chance to be successful? And it was clear that with what you were doing, that answer was yes. And the third thing was, can I help? Do I think I can help? And I got to answer all those three questions, and they were clear to me, you know, when I met you and Joe and the team. And what I liked is some of the things I'll reiterate again. I like the fact that you were in the space of secondary and tertiary markets before anybody was talking about them.
Yeah.
Now everybody's trying to talk about them, but they don't have an operating company.
Yeah.
And you have an operating company that can really service all aspects of the business.
We are sitting here in Modesto, California.
right. And, you know, the Johnny-come-latelys in the space, you know, they're dabbling in it, but they've got their hands in one side or the other side, and they really don't have a track record of performance. And you've got 17 years of performance. Mm-hmm. It's been, you know, very attractive returns for your investor. So that was that. And I like the strategy of how you've done it with the corridors, the interstate highways north and south, and invested along those highways. It was a great strategy, and it continues to be a great strategy. And the fact that you're doing things that are under the radar screen, and you can do it on your own. There's not a lot of fanfare. You're getting things done. And I like the pipeline.
Yeah.
I mean, pipelines ebb and flow, but you usually have a robust pipeline in what you're doing, and you have a track record for executing.
Yeah.
And sellers know that you can execute.
Yeah.
And that's really important as well.
Well, I appreciate that very much. Yeah. There are, you know, young people starting into our industry all the time, mm-hmm. and you've had this vantage point of being able to see the industry evolve over time. Do you have any advice that you could give to people that are starting new in the industry?
Yeah.
And what they can do as they think about their career?
Yeah, I've mentioned, I've mentored a number of people, a lot of young people. I like to do that, and I'm doing it probably with five or six people right now. And the advice I give to them, I give them a few different aspects, nothing that you would exactly hear from everybody. But the first thing I do is I say, you're part of a team. You've got to be a team player. You've got to learn. You've got to be with the people. And I get a little concerned with remote access because you don't get the fiber of the company and the culture of the company. So I get a little concerned. So I said, spend as much time as you can with people in the office learning. And then the second thing I always tell them, I said, you know, present. Present your presentation skills are very important.
Yep.
So a lot of people don't like to present, but you take every opportunity that you can to present to committees. If you have a chance to present to clients, it really is so important for your future that you could communicate a real estate strategy, that you could present. Very important. And always do it with a little sense of humor, too.
Yeah.
The world is very serious right now, but you always have to have a little sense of humor when you're presenting as well.
Very true. Just as we're rounding out here, I would love to, if you could tell us a little bit about your car hobby.
Oh,
yeah. I know you've got a little bit of a appreciation for cars, particular ones.
I have three sort of hobbies that I like to do. And when I was growing up and when the mid-year Corvettes came out, 1963 to 1967, I always wanted one. I couldn't afford one. And if you could afford one, you couldn't afford the insurance. So the family, myself, my daughter, my son-in-law, we own three Corvettes. We own a 1965 yellow Corvette. We own a 1967 green saddle leather interior. Wow. Both are beautiful cars. And then I bought a car when I lived in Atlanta, a 1995 black convertible.
Oh, yeah.
And that. So we've had a lot of fun with the Corvettes. And then the second thing I collect jukeboxes.
Yes, that's right.
So I have a jukebox collection from, three of them are from 1943.
Wow.
And they play 78 RPM records.
Full size.
Full size records. Yeah. And they sound, the bass, they sound terrific. And then the third thing I love to do is sport fishing. And I did a lot of sport fishing in Hawaii. I recently sold my boat there, but we were very proud being in ESG that we tagged and released 300 plus Pacific blue marlin.
Wow.
And we were conservationists and we tagged every one of those along the way. So that was important to us.
Well, if people stick to their real estate career, they too can have some of the similar hobbies.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking the time to interview today. Really appreciate it. And thank you for your service on our advisory board.
Thank you, Ryan. It's my pleasure.